Off the Ball, GAA.
But with the new rules, you feel like you don't understand the game anymore to an extent, in that, you know, these 8, 10, 12 point leads do not mean anything like what they used to before.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join. Off the Ball Daily.
Very good evening to you. You're welcome along to Wednesday night's Off the Ball. It's Owen here with you until 10 o'clock this evening. We're going to be getting the ball rolling on the Munster and Connacht football finals tonight from 7:30. John Mahon is a man who's won the finals in both provinces as a manager. So we're going to be chatting to him about Clare's famous Munster win in 1992 from 7:30. From 8 o'clock, we've got Wednesday night rugby with Gerry Thornley coming your way. Dorothy Wall news is a sickening blow for the women's team ahead of this year's World Cup, which came out today. We'll be chatting to him about Les Kiss taking over and succeeding Joe Schmidt after the Lions tour. And we will, of course, be looking ahead to Leinster versus Northampton this weekend. After 9 o'clock, then, we'll be chatting to John Bruin about the Champions League. And we've got an interview with Republic of Ireland and Burnley midfielder Josh Cullen coming your way before we wrap up tonight as well. As ever, you can drop us a message on WhatsApp. 0879 180 180 is our number. Or on social media, at Off the Ball is our handle. Cameron Hill is your newsman this evening. Cameron, how are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
Very well. And Richie McCormack.
Hello.
Welcome to the evenings.
It's very strange to be back in this segment. ordinarily at this time, I'm just walking around the house giving team news updates to my kids and telling them what's gone on in the snooker that day. It fills the half hour and it entertains them no end. I can tell by their faces.
I'm very confused. Didn't I slay you? And that's how I got...
Pretty much, this. Yeah. No, or it was your imaginary brother who
doesn't exist.
For long-time listeners of the Crappy Quiz will know that Cameron does indeed have an imaginary brother who sends in questions to the show.
Yes,
in an effort to try and massage his scores.
Yeah. I'd say it's me with a mustache, but I already have one. So
his name is Hammer and Kill, and he sends in questions for the quiz every week, and we don't believe that he actually exists.
What a great name.
Yeah. I was going to introduce you as Late Night McCormack, which obviously pertains to you being on News Talk, filling in for Tom Dunn on The Regular, but also what I've come to realise is that you become a late night expert. Your reading at the moment is very much US talk show late night based, is it not?
Yeah, well, I've just finished, literally as I was waiting to come on this show,
right
outside. I've been putting in the prep for this particular appearance, obviously. I just finished a biography on David Letterman, which is one of a series of books that I've read about late night hosts down through the years. There are two, I've probably mentioned this before, but bears repeating. There's two books by Bill Carter, both of which center on late night wars. The first of them is about the battle between Jay Leno and David Letterman to get the Tonight Show in the early 90s. And the second one he wrote was of a similar situation, which was over the battle for the Tonight Show, essentially between Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien in the 2000s. The first of which is genuinely one of the best books I've ever written. The level of detail and research in it is magnificent, which extends to Jay Leno eavesdropping on a major meeting by sitting in, hiding in a wardrobe. I'm not making that
story
up.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So those are fantastic books. This book I just read on Letterman as well. Good, but you're not going to get to know him because Letterman will never let you in that much.
Really?
Even in the interviews that obviously would have gone into the research for this particular book, Jason Zinnemann is the name of the author of that one. Insofar as a David Letterman book can be excellent, this was excellent.
So it comes somewhat recommended, recommended.
Do. If you're into that kind of thing, you know, by all means, pick it up.
We've got a text in immediately asking for Richie McCormack's take on the David Gray story, which has been covered quite a bit on the station today, apparently. Richie, apparently the
it's all over News Talk social media.
Yeah, bleeding into
the bars have been closed.
What's happening
at David Gray's story? So, I mean, this is obviously an either or question. Are the problem is a problem here? You know, the ravenous David Gray fans that exist out there, or is it
crazy
humankind in general?
They're similar to the new wave of British heavy metal fans that existed in the late 70s, early 80s. Tigers of Pantang fans have nothing on those of David Gray. But what I will say about the bars situation is people are going to drink before the gig anyway, so the bars being closed during it is probably moot. But what I will say, and loath as I am to make sweeping statements about entire, you know, swathes of people, is that crowds at gigs since COVID have become appalling. Like, genuinely, some of the worst instances I've ever had at gigs have all been post COVID, because. And this happened with driving as well. People kind of forgot how to drive properly and how to behave themselves properly on the roads to a degree. And it's very true of gigs. Like the Pulp gig that I went to in St. Anne's 2 years ago now will be this year is one of the worst gig experiences I've ever had. Like, you're used to people kind of being out and about and enjoying themselves, but you're talking about huge tranches of the crowd there, not just like the one or two near you, like massive amounts of people. No interest in what's going on stage.
Mm.
Like, I saw people who'd clearly raided the merch tent to get a t-shirt, had maybe gotten another piece of merch and gone up to the bars. No interest in what's going on stage. Like, literally they're back sideways or turned to the stage to talk to their friends, not just even the sideways kind of whisper in somebody's ear. And that was just all over the place. Just genuinely just awful. Awful experience.
It extends beyond gigs, though, doesn't it?
Cinemas.
It's unwatchable now.
Yeah.
I can't sit in a cinema anymore. Even for, like, films like... I saw Gladiator 2, which I no disrespect to Paul Mescal or his shorts, which are in the studio right now.
Yep.
But it was so tough. People just talking right the way through it in very tense scenes. Mm. And you just... I don't know. Yeah, it has to be a post-COVID thing. But I remember I was at New Dad, this really good Irish band.
New EP coming this Friday?
Yes, indeed. And the brilliant in the Button Factory. And they were playing songs that were like ostensibly designed to get people up and dancing. And it was the deadest atmosphere I've ever experienced. It was funereal.
Yeah, there is something snapped within the general populace about how to act in big social gatherings. Really did.
That's so interesting. I actually hadn't really overly noticed it. Maybe at the very start post-COVID, I thought we'd kind of corrected ourselves at this point.
Because what happens is only built upon. So people kind of see what you're able to get away with and then they push that even further. And the limits of what's acceptable comes
when it turns out that etiquette is just that and it's not a hard written rule and is easily breached.
People don't give a monkeys. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're having this conversation as we're watching a crowd that could be a 1980s crowd, could be a 1990s crowd, could be a 2000s crowd, except for the presence of phones.
And Luca Bressel.
And Luca Bressel, who was on screen.
Everyone else, yeah.
At the Crucible, this comfort blanket that we always have and we were talking about last night. Like, people would have been out enjoying the sunshine today. We were doing our favourite sunshine activity.
Oh yeah,
shortly after
snooker.
Lunchtime. Watching snooker.
Yeah.
And we watched an absolute classic earlier, Richie.
We did. Williams and Higgins was amazing. John Higgins managed to throw the match away twice after building up a lead, surrendering it, and then having a chance, I think twice in the final frame, to put the match to bed. Squandered it. Missed a fairly routine blue, which allowed Mark Williams in to clear up the table and take the final frame victory. It was fantastic. It was one of those games that just reminds you why you do love snooker and why you do love that sport and what drama it can bring. Like, even last night's matches as well were fantastic. But it's one of those things you're kind of going, nobody with any sense or a job is watching this. this is for an audience that just doesn't exist at the moment. I mean, yeah, it's weird. People kind of go on about snooker, but, you know, oh, there's no more, you know, there's no characters left in the game. They are what they are. They are what you manage to present them as. And you can present anybody as anything if you really want it. The problem with it is that snooker's bones, similarly with darts, and its popularity boom was associated with it getting larger television exposure. And people are suddenly surprised that they don't know much about snooker when that television exposure shrinks and moves away, which you only do really have the World Championships and a couple of other tournaments on BBC during the year. ITV had picked up the slack a little bit. But Eurosport and now TNT Sports are beyond most viewers. Mm. We can see that in the split between terrestrial viewing numbers and satellite/pay TV numbers. And cricket, like, cricket's the same. Cricket's like, I pretty knew, like, cricketers when they're growing up. But with behind Sky, it's not something that you just stumble across anymore.
Yeah, but at least we do have the World Championship on BBC.
Thank God. And the worst thing that could happen to this now is that it is moved to Saudi Arabia, which is the ultimate goal of Barry Hearn, is to shove the whole thing off into the Middle East and have it be played there. There is, like, the problem with snooker is it doesn't know how to present itself properly. With darts, you can whip everybody up into a fervor and they can keep them at that. And they can drink through it and they can sing their songs. With snooker, you're asking, and you see Rob Walker doing the great intros before the players come into the Crucible, is that they give it the beans. Like, he's like, oh, blah, blah, blah. He talks them up. He's done this in his career. He's done that. He throws in a nickname and it's away. And then it all has to subside immediately afterwards into silence. Because it has to, because that's what snooker is and that's how it's played. But it's a difficult thing to want to add a bit of showbiz and razzmatazz to when the expectation is, unlike a David Gray crowd or a Tigers of Pantan crowd, you have to be quiet and sit completely still.
As a television audience, though, I mean, is there not something, as I referred to it earlier, like the comfort blanket nature of the snooker on BBC on Maybank Holiday?
It's one of those sports that you can allow wash over you.
Yeah.
You can sit there and just have the clack of the balls and the random applause of the crowd there at the Crucible. In the same way, you'll hear balls being struck and crowds at Edgbaston or Headingley or Old Trafford applauding along to well-played fours or sixes. And it's just something that you can just have on the background. You can touch base with it. If it becomes interesting, then you suddenly find yourself engrossed in it a little bit more, as we all did in the office earlier on with Williams and Higgins. But yeah, given the time frame of it and the way that the game expands and the patience that it requires and all that stuff, it is a nice comfort blanket sport.
Yeah, sure. Well, Ronnie O'Sullivan has just got back underway. It'll be in Cameron's News Round, I'm sure, but we are starting this evening, Cameron.
Well, that's what it's called, is it?
Yeah, it's Cameron's News Round. Again, I killed you, so.
Gaelic Games is where you're going first.
Yeah, and Dublin have been handed a tough draw for the group stages of the All-Ireland Football Championship. Desi Farrell's side are in Group 4, already being dubbed the Group of Death, with Derry, the winner of Mayo against Galway in the Connacht final, and the beaten team in the Ulster final. That's either going to be All-Ireland champions Armagh or Donegal. But Dublin's Niall Scully says they can have no complaints, as they didn't deserve to beat Meath in the Leinster Championship at the weekend.
We can have no complaints. I think Meath were probably the better team on the day, and we just didn't perform in the closing moments of the game. You know, we were just turning the ball over and probably had a bit of poor decision making. And to be fair to Meath, they punished us in the first half and they held on to that lead then in the second.
The straw is quite interesting in that when it comes to the Connacht final this weekend, there's a case to be made that the loser of the Connacht final will actually have a slightly easier draw when it comes to Sam Maguire. So just a reminder there that the Connacht runner-up will be in with Tyrone, Cavan and the Ulster winner, whereas the Connacht winner will be up against the other side of Armagh, Donegal, but also Dublin and Derry. It's such a strange thing that this happens this week, this draw, as opposed to next week in 2 weeks' time when these games are done. I guess they probably have to get ahead of things with regards to some element of fixtures, but we still don't know the full identity of these groups either.
Somebody in the office, I won't name names, said, sure, why would you want to win the Connacht final at the weekend, given the draw that came this afternoon? But yeah, it's like, was there... Like, there probably is a procedural element, as you mentioned there, and all that kind of jazz to go along with why this draw was made today. It surely could have waited 3-4 days just to see how things pan out, but yeah. There we are.
Sorry, I've actually interrupted you, Cameron. You're going to go through the groups there.
Yeah, so a win in the Munster final will earn Kerry or Clare a place in Group 2. That's alongside Roscommon, Cork and the Leinster runner-ups, so Louth or Meath. Group 3 will see the Leinster champions face the beaten team in Munster, as well as Monaghan and Down, while Tyrone, Cavan, the Connacht runner-up and the winner in Ulster will contest Group 1. The Tailteann Cup draw was also done today, so Division 3 league champions Offaly have been paired with Wicklow, Waterford and their neighbours Leitrim in Group 2. Group 1 sees Kildare take on Tipperary, Leitrim and Sligo. Former winners Westmeath will face Limerick, Antrim and London in Group 3. And Group 4 has Fermanagh, Wexford, Carlow and Longford.
Yeah, so the top line from that Sam Maguire draw was always going to be, where do Dublin end up? And as you've already mentioned, it's that group of death, but Dublin going away to whoever wins Connacht, so either Mayo or Galway. That's the blue ribbon fixture of this year's championship in the group stages. So that's the identity of that. Personally, I was hoping for Kerry Dublin in Killarney, which would have been historic and amazing, but it's going to be Mayo or Galway that get them at home in the championship. Where do you want to go next?
Well, there are three provincial finals tonight in the Dalata Hotel Group Under 20 Football Championships tonight. So Mayo and Roscommon are currently contesting the Connacht final in Tuam, while at 7:30 Donegal and Tyrone do battle for the Ulster honours at Owen Beg, while at the same time in Newbridge it's Louth against Meath in the Leinster decider, and the latest score from the Connacht final is Mayo 1-5 to Roscommon's 1 point.
Champions League, second semi-final first leg tonight, Cameron.
The second, yes, as you say. So Barcelona taking on Inter at 8 o'clock, 4 days after they beat their rivals Real Madrid in the final of the Copa del Rey. And manager Hansi Flick hopes they can carry the momentum from Sunday's win into the game in Montjuic tonight.
Everyone is focused. Everyone knows, okay, how important is this semi-final to reach a final. And of course, also this win against Real, It's very important also for the positive vibes, no, and for the positive moments, and it could push you also. So for me is this the key, and We know that we have to work hard also to reach the final, and I think the Inter have a team. There are some players also in the age, maybe is the last opportunity to reach the final, and they will give 100%. This is clear, and also what we have to do.
Barcelona's team, it's Wojciech Szczęsny in goal, the back four of Jules Koundé, Pau Cubarsí, Inigo Martinez and Gerard Martin. It's Frenkie de Jong and Pedri in midfield, behind Lamine Yamal, Dani Olmo, Rafinha and Ferran Torres. For Inter Milan, it's Jan Sommer in goal, the back three of Bastoni, Acerbi and Bissek. Then it's Dumfries and DiMarco as their wing-backs, a midfield three of Mkhitaryan, Calhanoglu and Barella, and Lautaro Martinez and Marcus Thuram up front, that deadly duo.
Thuram was a shock because he'd been carrying a bit of a knee strain, I think it was, or a thigh strain coming into this game. So he was expected only to be on the bench. Clearly, Simone Inzaghi has decided that tonight is the night if they're going to pick up results and has thrown him in at the deep end. What a story Wojciech Szczęsny would be, by the way.
Yeah.
To be dragged out of retirement in October and thrust into Barcelona of all places. It's not as if he went playing for Barnet like Edgar Davids. It's like, oh, you're going to play for Barcelona. And they're suddenly going to go on the run of all runs and win everything. And you're going to be central to that. Like, he's not being dislodged for the rest of the Champions League campaign because they'd have to deregister him to put Ter Stegen back in. He mightn't even get a game, Ter Stegen, in La Liga between now and the end of the season. And Wojciech, gone from smoking cigars on his holidays to just casually winning a treble.
Well, that's the thing. He will be smoking in the dressing room if they win the Champions League, like Lamine Yamal.
I'll be smoking in the dressing room at half time, for God's sake. Yeah.
Lamine Yamal will be looking around the dressing room. You'll see this lad smoking cigarettes as they win the biggest prize in club football. It'll be pretty amazing. Like, it's impossible to not talk about this game and not just think about 2010. We briefly mentioned it yesterday, but I mean, that semi final, the 1-0 defeat, the greatest defeat of my career, as Jose Mourinho dubbed it. It has to be one of the most memorable semi-finals in Champions League history.
That's the one, obviously, where he full suit went and did a knee slide on the pitch and got sprinklered off.
They got sprinklered off. Barcelona had to resort to the pettiness of turning the sprinklers on.
So you love that. That's brilliant. Bring more of that needle back into it. We need more fighting in football like that.
I was reading Jonathan Wilson writing about that piece around that game earlier on, and the Zlatan Pep beef going into that game was pretty fascinating as well. I think Zlatan had been dropped for a game the previous week, and what did he call him? He referred to him as a frightened little overthinker with his team of obedient little schoolboys. Was how he described his own Barcelona team on that occasion. And I think
Jose, that inaccurate?
I mean, I'm sure Jose Mourinho would have gone along with what Zlatan was thinking, but this sort of caricature of Jose Mourinho, it's not really a character. The fact of Jose Mourinho is some sort of outsider at Barcelona as well. Just the satisfaction he got from that particular win and obviously going on to win the Champions League that season. It's just an enduring image, as you mentioned, him running onto the pitch, the sprinkler. And I'm not sure we'll get something on that level of drama over the course of these two legs, but you go through those two 11s and it's going to be a very intriguing tie.
I love the way this Inter one is, as like, I think Hansi Flick and Top of the Positive Wipes there talked about the Last Chance Saloon for a couple of these Inter players, and it's very much the case. Like, Henrik Mkhitaryan is in that midfield, 36 years of age. Francesco Acerbi is 37. It would be brilliant for both of those to be able to reach a Champions League final, and I know they're on a bad run Inter at the moment. I think they've lost the last three in a row, including against AC Milan in the Coppa Italia. But, they have been so hard to beat in the Champions League this season that as good as Barcelona have been, I really find it hard to bet against Inter at least coming away from this game in a competitive situation for the second leg and getting it back in the San Siro in a week's time. It will be interesting. If they do come away with a two-goal deficit at most, I'd still give Inter a sniff in the second leg.
Speaking of Wojciech Szczęsny, did you see what he said about Arsenal recently? Journalists were asking him if he'd be supporting Arsenal, would they be his second team in the Champions League? And he said, absolutely not.
What am I?
And he said, being an Arsenal fan is constant suffering.
Paging Dr. Onana.
I mean, is he wrong again?
It would be against the brand of Arsenal, is what he's saying, to go on and win this year's Champions League. And I don't know, maybe he's completely correct. It seems that, opening up social media this morning, it seems that there's a lot of people having a go at Arsenal after last night, having a go at Arsenal fans, having a go at the TIFO.
Did you take that personally?
AFTV's own Sheehan says.
Yeah, I don't know. What's this about? I think there was a lot of angry Arsenal fans afterwards who maybe went a little bit over the top on AFTV, as you say, but I can't believe the level of vitriol towards Arsenal this morning. What's that about?
I think it's a case of, we all saw what they did against Real Madrid, which they managed that tie, I think, impeccably, I think you'd say. It's hard to pick a fault in what they did over the two legs. And all of the atmosphere that went into the home leg of that at the Emirates, and all of the hard work that went into that, and the moments of great skill, particularly from Declan Rice on those two free kicks, it just seemed a little flat yesterday. There was a brilliant atmosphere in the build-up, but that seemed to, the goal had a large part to play in that in 3 minutes. But they didn't seem to be able to pick themselves up from that after that. And it's not as if they were down on themselves. It was just they were in a game. They were participating in a semi-final rather than trying to win one. And I don't know, you kind of figured there should be more from an Arsenal. But then when you have a team that's playing Mikel Merino as a false nine in a Champions League semi-final, with the greatest respect to Mikel Merino, what do you expect from them, really?
Yeah.
What do you expect from that side? So I think maybe some of the vitriol is a bit performative. There will be a lot of that with Arsenal fans, unfortunately. They had that goal disallowed, rightly, obviously, in the start of the second half. I think you wanted to see more of them last night, and they were probably a little bit too cautious and careful when you want to go out and win a semi-final rather than just hang in there, and Arsenal haven't been a great watch all season.
No, they haven't, and it kind of resorted to a little bit of that as well in the third quarter of the game, really, when there was a certain degree of parking the bus from PSG, and then they realised they're actually a brilliant attacking team and went back on
the
ascendancy. I know, they are unbelievable to watch, yeah. PSG. We're turning our attention to Hamer Halgrimsson. He's been speaking today, Cameron.
Yeah, and he's revealed that the FAI struggled to find opposition for the friendlies planned in June. So the Boys in Green, of course, will host Senegal at the Aviva Stadium on the 6th of June before a trip to Luxembourg 4 days later. Halgrimsson was speaking to our own David Wilson and explained how he planned to bring some League of Ireland players into the squad this summer.
Honestly, we plan to have a camp in May, right after the championship finished, so we could play the championship players then and then give them the holiday off. But unfortunately, one of the opponents pulled out and we couldn't find a replacement. Yeah. That would have been ideal, and then we would have taken some of these players that probably will be in June and play them there, yeah. Opening spaces in June for the likes of players in the League of Ireland. But because we missed out on those games, probably the spots that we plan to have open are fewer than we wanted. But there's always a possibility to see a League of Ireland player, for sure.
Yeah, this has been a bit of a talking point ever since Stephen Bradley had a hit back at Hamer Halgrimsson earlier this year. Who would the identity of the League of Ireland player be? Josh Honohan?
Josh Honohan, probably. It's
in a competitive position.
It's actually really tricky to pick out who, and this isn't clearly I'm coming from a League of Ireland fan perspective. It's actually really tricky to pick out who it would be to land in what is an international calibre squad. I know every team or every supporter of a team would have their own personal favourite. But I think the reality of the situation is the amount of players within the league that are in a position and at an age where they're capable of playing international football is actually pretty low still at the moment. That's just being realistic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Swansea City?
Yeah, they've appointed Alan Sheehan as their new permanent head coach on a 3-year deal. So the Athlone native has had an impressive spell as caretaker boss following the departure of Luke Williams in February. Since taking charge, Sheehan has brought the side from 8 points above the relegation zone up to 11th in the championship. And former Shamrock Rovers midfielder Liam Burt has signed for NIFL Premiership side Glentoran. The Scot spent last season on loan at Shelburne helping Damien Duff's side to the Premier Division title. He reunites with former Bohemians boss Declan Devine there. His contract, of course, terminated by Rovers in February, with Burt taking to social media to lash out over his alleged mistreatment by the club.
You'll be a Glentoran season ticket holder now, Richie?
With Devine as manager, Liam Burt up there, Dylan Connolly already there, I'd imagine the team group chat is some crack. really, there's a bunch of characters up there. You want to see how they get on, yeah.
The Swansea news is fascinating as well. I mean, obviously, it's become a little bit more of a glamorous story with Luka Modric's investment in the club, so you'll have to make a decision next season. Are we going to call it Alan Sheehan Swansea City or Luka Modric's Swansea City? So we'll see how that one comes out in the wash. Turning to rugby.
Yeah, Munster's most capped player, Stephen Archer, has announced he will retire at the end of the season. The tight head made his debut against Edinburgh in October of 2009, going on to make 300 appearances for the province overall. His 300th came in that Champions Cup quarterfinal against Bordeaux. He's also earned two caps for Ireland in 2013. And Dorothy Wall says she's devastated to miss this year's Women's Rugby World Cup. The Exeter chief forward is having surgery today on an Achilles tendon injury, which will rule her out for a number of months. Earlier this month, Aaron King was also ruled out of the World Cup due to a knee injury.
So that's two thirds of Ireland's back row out of this year's World Cup. And it's just incredible how quickly the expectations can change. At least the one thing, if you want to be really glass half full on this, is that we won't be over expecting on this team, given two crucial components of that back row will be missing going into this World Cup in England later on this year. But it's just a massive setback for Scott Beamont.
Yeah, and I think getting to the knockout phase of the World Cup is probably the realistic aim of this team. And they have Spain and Japan as the winnable games in the group. And they know that they've already landed blows on the likes of the Black Ferns or the other team in the group as well. But losing, you know, Dorothy Wall, she played a lot in the second round, on the Six Nations, yeah, just gone. Aaron King from the back row as well. But the squad is a more competitive one than it was 12, 18 months ago even. So there is a chance for other players to step up. There's the sense that this hasn't happened on the eve of the tournament, which I think would have been a greater shock and a tougher thing to deal with. They do have a chance to bed others in the friendly games and in the camps that they'll have between now and the World Cup, and fingers crossed that they can make the most of it. But it is, like, it's just rotten luck for both players to have a World Cup on the horizon with the tide of Irish rugby in the women's game starting to rise again, and they get to miss out on such a showpiece like that, particularly when it's just over in England.
Exactly.
Like all that plays into it too.
Nevertheless, I was looking at the fixtures and they're playing New Zealand in the Amex Stadium. So that weekend in Brighton should be good crack for that game.
Absolutely.
Especially at the end of the group stages, mm-hmm, when Ireland should be in with a fair shot of qualifying for the knockouts. A couple of more stories to wrap up on. Cameron, our favourite sport, is up next.
Yeah, and we are watching on as the evening session gets underway at the World Snooker Championships in the Crucible. So Ronnie O'Sullivan still leading Si Jiaowei by 10 frames to 6. On the other table tonight, it's Luca Brasel against Judd Trump. That's at 8 frames all. Well, earlier, as you mentioned, Mark Williams won a final frame decider against John Higgins to book his place in the semi-finals. The 50-year-old held off a late comeback from his opponent to seal a 13 points to 12 victory.
And finally, Punchestown.
Yeah, Galopin Deschamps claimed a dominant victory for trainer Willie Mullins in the featured Gold Cup on day two of the Punchestown Festival. The Joseph O'Brien-trained Banbridge finished second, with Spillane's Tower coming in third.
Cameron Hill, thank you very much. Richie McCormack, enjoyed your company. Thanks for popping in.
Thanks, lads.
We'll see you soon. We're going to be speaking to John Mahan after the break. And before that, it's time for the Cash Machine.
Big news.
Are you sure we can tell this?
The Football Pod Live is back.
I'm telling you, lads, Gaelic football is back.
We're back on the road. First stop, Galway. Join Tommy Rooney, Paddy Andrews and James O'Donoghue at the Galmont Hotel in Galway.
To be honest, even if there is a hooter, no one knows what the f*** is going to happen.
Get your tickets now for a live episode of the pod ahead of the 2025 Connacht Senior Football Championship Final.
Jesus.
No.
Where we'll also be joined by some very special guests. This is an exclusive off-air event and tickets are limited, so check out the Off The Ball socials for info on how to get yours. The Football Pod, live in Galway. It's all in partnership with AIB. Check out hashtag the toughest for more.
It was quality.
This week on Diverted.
I was always around football. I used to carry the players' boots. I remember when my grandfather would bring the Brazilian players and I would wash their boots and everything. So it's definitely, football is built and stored in my DNA.
In episode 6, we're going to Central America and we'll be taking you to a Belizean Premier League game. We'll be visiting the basketball-obsessed highlands of Guatemala.
You need to have a name order that people support. Like, for instance, basketball, you have LeBron James. It starts like that. You have to find good players so that you can sell it to the public so they can come out and support.
And we will experience firsthand the 2 minutes and 58 seconds where it looked like Costa Rica were going to qualify for the knockout stages of the 2022 World Cup.
I am once again embracing my new brothers.
What are you doing?
Creating chaos.
Diverted. Coming every Tuesday to your podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts.
Off The Ball Daily.